want to welcome you all to the annual Lakatos Award Lecture, which is given this evening by Judea Pearl. It's a special treat and delight to have Judea here this evening because he does philosophy of science in the LSE way, which I, of course, think is the very best way to do philosophy of science. And there are two characteristics of Pearl's work. One is that the science and the philosophy flow seamlessly together, and the other is that it's rigorous, but it's rigorous with a bite. That is, Pearl does a lot of formal work, but when he does the formal work, it's clear what the premises mean, and it's clear how methodologically we can use the conclusions. Now, it's not, I think, such a surprise that Pearl has seamlessly moves back and forth between philosophy and science, because he has, that's what he's done with his life. Judea Pearl started and has a PhD in electrical engineering. He works in a computer science department, and he's written by far and away the best philosophy of science book of the year, and I hope, I don't mean to be damning with faint praise, I mean, it's absolutely magnificent work on causes, counterfactuals, and probabilities, and it's rather embarrassing and distressing to the rest of us who are about his age, people like me who have spent my entire career just in philosophy and have never produced anything which has either the philosophical depth or the formal rigor of Judea Pearl's work, and I'm really absolutely wonderfully delighted to have him here this evening. Judea?
Thank you, Nancy. You don't have to feel so bad. You actually inspired me.
Thank you.
The title of my talk here is too ambitious, as anyone can see. I'm not going to cover the logic of science in its entirety. What I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on causal modeling as a microcosm in which you can see some of the questions raised before in philosophy of science being represented. It's a nice and neat microcosm in which you can see the problem of philosophy of science represented clearly, parsimoniously, neatly, in such a way that they lend themselves to mathematical precision. So going through causal modeling, I will point to some general aspect of the logic of science and see what we can learn from them. Here's an overview of what I'm going to say. The threading theme will be the effect of language. I mean, I'm going to present here a hierarchy of languages and a hierarchy of questions and queries that one might ask. I'll start on the top of the hierarchy. You see statistical model. Those are on top because they are the most primitive and the least powerful of all. Okay. Unfortunately, this is the only layer in which lend themselves to precise mathematical analysis until very recently. And a lot of confusion came about due to the fact that people try to answer deep philosophical questions using statistical models. And a lot of confusion came about due to the inability of the language to capture the deep philosophical questions that prevails in scientific theories. And let me go over the scope and the languages. The scope is the kind of queries that one might want to ask a theory. A theory is a slide rule, or it's a computer or automaton or a hand calculator that answers questions. That's what a theory is. Okay? The user of a theory asks a query. You want to know what happens if I raise the temperature or I raise taxes. And the theory gives you an answer. This is going to be the effect. And the scope is the kind of query that one might wish to ask, the kind of answers one can expect to receive. And the language is the grammar in which one can express those queries. Causal models come in two varieties, stochastic and deterministic, or functional, and the scope related to them varies from interventions to counterfactuals. That means that in statistics, you simply ask questions about observations. If I see that, what can I expect to see tomorrow? Okay. If I see that today, how likely it is that one can that a certain observation took place yesterday, and so on. It's a relationship between observations. In causal models, you have relationship between observations and interventions. If I do that, then I can expect something to happen. In functional causal models, which is the deeper into the hierarchy, you have more complex, more refined questions. It has to do with counterfactuals. Had I not done that, then certain things would not have happened. Down there we have the general scientific theories, the kind we find in physics or in economics. Those are separated from the top by dots here for good reasons, that we still don't have a theory to capture the entirety. The languages used here is propositional logic plus modality, some subjunctives, and here we probably need the full power of first-order logic or even second-order logic to capture the kind of question that a scientist raises in dealing with the scientific theories. We need to have object and object properties relationship, for instance, just to capture the idea that two particles are in contact with each other, okay? It's a difficult relation to express in the propositional logic. And those are the kind of, this is a perception that a scientist has when dealing with particles, people, social interaction, and so on. So I'm just giving you that overview in order to express the difficulty in capturing the entire scientific, the language of scientific theories, as opposed to what we can do today in terms of statistical models and causal models. Now let's go, what I'm going to do during the talk will be to focus on the mathematical properties of those languages in which that we can handle. Statistical languages are the easiest one, and the main transitions that I've seen taking place in the past 15 years has been the transition between the statistical models and causal models. Okay. 10 or 20 years from now, we are going to see progress in that transition, going from equational models to the full power and refinement of scientific theories involving first-order language and so on. So the outline of my talk will be the distinction between statistical and causal models, the transition that one needs to go through going from statistical to causal models. I'll talk about causal models and identifiability, a very important concept. I'll talk about inferences to three types of claims, the claims that make up the scope of the theories. Claims about effect of potential intervention, claims about attribution or responsibility, claims about direct and indirect effect, all those fall under the causal models. This is the kind of special claims that causal models permits one to ask and to answer. And then I'll talk about some relationships, to the general questions that people in the philosophy of science have raised, namely questions of falsifiability and corroborations. We'll see how they behave in the context of causal models and what we can learn about them about general theories. Let's start with the statistical versus causal distinction. the statistical paradigm, one assumes that data is governed by a mathematical entity called joint distribution function. One observes data, and one tries to infer properties of the joint distribution functions. For instance, since I'm in the London School of Economics, I'll give you an example taken from e-commerce. Infer whether customers who bought product A would also buy product B. That's a tremendous amount of money is encapsulated in that kind of questions. Okay? And marketing and e-commerce and whatever you want, right? Yes, is covered by that kind of questions. And what it is simply to answer the following query. Find the probability of B given A, where B is the proposition that the customers buy product B, and A being a customer buy product A. Right? This is an aspect of the joint probability function. And one needs to infer that by looking at data. Right? So this is a basic statistical paradigm, very clear, very scientific, and I would even dare to say that all statistical problems fall into that kind of picture. Okay? Nothing more sophisticated than that. Sometimes you have the probability, joint probability distribution can be very complex. Sometimes the A and the Bs can be very complex. But basically, it boils down to finding those aspects of probability of the joint probability distributions. And the most complex sentence expressing aspect of joint probability distribution is simply conditional probability. There aren't any more connectives. Where A and B are general Boolean sentences. What about causal models? Let's a step deeper. Instead of this hypothetical joint probability function that we had before P, now we have data generating model. It's a model that tells you for every variable how it is determined, what determines the value of that variable. Once you have, if you have a data generating model, you also have a probability distributions governing the data. And the task of the causal inference exercise is to infer from data aspect of what? Not of Q, not of P, not of the joint probability function, but of the data generating model. For example, here is a query that cannot be inferred from just a joint probability, but can be inferred if you have M, the data generating model. Infer whether customers who bought product A would still buy product A if we double the price of A. Okay? What makes it so strange is that we now have if we double the price. Namely, we have here an intervention. And queries which involve intervention cannot be answered by a joint probability function, even if you had it. Okay? So even if you have a precise, refined joint probability function on all variables of interest, you cannot answer a query of that nature. What will happen if we double? I will elaborate on that. Okay? But let me repeat in a way. What makes the difference between statistical and causal analysis is the fact that statistics and probability are exercises in static relationships. Okay. In statistics, you go from data and joint distribution. In probability, as a mathematical exercise, is inferring the relationship between joint distribution and some property of that joint distribution. For instance, make inferences from past observations. Step further, causal analysis deals with changes, the dynamics. It deals with the question of what remains invariant once P changes. So if I give you, and I tell you that some certain aspect of the joint probability has changed, one must know what doesn't change in order to compute the aspect of causal relationships. For instance, P itself, if I give you a probability function, doesn't tell you how that function will change, ought to change, if I vary a certain aspect of P. In order to do that, I give you an example. For instance, if I give you the joint probability function of symptom and disease, okay, there's nothing in the joint probability function that tells you that if I cure the disease, I will also eliminate the symptom. Or that if I eliminate the symptoms, the disease will not be eliminated. Okay? That information that makes this asymmetry requires some additional knowledge in addition to what is conveyed by the joint probability function. The analogy that I like to use is a mechanical deformation. If I have an object here and I give you the surface condition of the object, then describing the surface of the object will allow you to predict how that object will be viewed from various angles. That is correspond to the probability function. But it doesn't tell you how that object will be deformed if I squeeze it. In order to predict the deformation, one needs to know what remains invariant, namely what the object is made of, what the resiliency is, or elasticity. And that information doesn't come from the surface condition. It comes from knowing the resiliency or the consistency of that material that makes up the object. That corresponds to causal information that needs to supplement the probabilistic information one gets from a joint distribution function. So corresponding to a joint distribution, we have now a causal model, and the causal analysis exercise involves inferring properties of the causal model from what? Data, causal assumptions, and experiments. The kind of queries one answers would be the effect of intervention, finding the causes of reported events, and explanations. I will not talk about explanation, although this is a nice subject to talk about. And let me now continue into the difference between causal and statistical concepts. Here are some notions that one finds in the statistical literature. Some of them are causal and some are statistical. It's a very simple dichotomy between causal and statistical notions. Every notion that can be defined in terms of a joint probability function, right, is statistical. At least I define as statistical. Notions that cannot be computed, even if you have a precise description of a joint probability function, is causal. So here are some examples. Regression. Oops, okay. My mistake. Regression, associations, conditioning, odds and risk ratio, collapsibility, all those are notions that are statistical by our definition. Here are notions which cannot be computed thus from the joint distribution, and therefore they are causal. For instance, spurious correlation. For instance, randomization. Although it appears in the first chapter of many statistics books, randomization is inherently a causal concept and not a statistical concept. Because one, if I give you a joint distribution, you cannot tell me which variable is randomized. Proof. Confounding. An instrumental variable. Holding something constant. Explanatory variables. All those notions that you can find in the social science, economics, econometrics, literature, these are causal notions. They have no statistical definition. Nancy put it nicely. If you take this dichotomy, then you end up with a recognition that the two do not mix. that one cannot infer causal notions from statistical assumptions alone. One needs to augment those with causal assumptions. Which also means that causal assumptions, even if you are willing to start the exercise with causal assumptions, one cannot do that in the language of statistics, in the language that you find today, the mathematics, in statistical textbooks. One needs to augment that using new mathematics. That awareness is something that many statisticians would resist, because many statisticians do causal thinking and causal analysis using the mathematics of standard statistical text. Okay? And the reason they can do that because they're very good in doing things in their head. Okay? But if you want to do things formally and precisely, the mathematics must change, must be enriched. And I'll talk about some enrichment. What do I mean by non-standard mathematics? For example, the structural equation model. That's something that every economist knows. Not every economist is aware of the fact that he or she is using non-standard mathematics, not standard statistics, or counterfactual, as appears in the Neeman-Rubin models or in Lewis models, or causal diagram, as appears in Sybil White writings. And I'll talk about the ingredient that makes them non-standard. Now, what is the causal model? Like every model, it's an oracle. It's an oracle that assigns truth value to queries. In our case, we are talking about causal models, so the queries of interest are queries which involve causal relationships. For example, an action sentence. B if we do A. B would be the case if we go ahead and do A. Counterfactual. B would be different if A were true. Explanation. B occurred because of A. Optional, you can answer query, you can ask with what probability this would be the case. Now, those are non-standard, as I said, since they cannot be answered using the language of joint distribution. Here's an example of a causal model. It's not an horrendous entity. It's something that everyone is familiar with. If it weren't, I wouldn't be here today. It's a logic diagram. Every engineer can infer the output from the input. But notice three interesting properties of that miraculous invention. First, that diagram can answer queries about intervention. I can, for instance, ask what will be the output, Z, if I were to ground Y to zero, okay, or connect it to a power supply of 1,000 volts. Okay. So, or if I replace this AND gate with an OR gate. Okay. These kind of queries cannot be answered if you had the Boolean function description of the same circuit. Okay. That's property number two. You need to have the diagram to answer those queries. And the third property to notice here is that the designer of that circuit did not have in mind that kind of queer queries, right, connect this Y to zero. Who would ever think about such a strange manipulation when the circuit was not meant to be manipulated by strange things that replace this AND gate with an OR gate? And still, despite the fact that the designer did not contemplate such queries, every engineer can look at the circuit and answer the queries of that nature and the billion and trillion such combination of such queries. Okay? Replace this OR gate by an AND gate, ground Y to zero, and whatever. Okay? Make many combinations of that. Okay. Where is the power coming from? the power to answer such complex queries. The power comes from the simple trick of giving symbolic representation to the gates. What's special about the gates? Those are relationships which remain invariant under intervention. If I ground y to zero, this end gate will remain an end gate. And every other connection here will remain, its functional characteristic will remain the same. The only thing which will vary would be the input to the y. So giving symbolic representation to the invariant components in our environment, that what gives the causal model its power of expression. Let me demonstrate it. Oh, first let me generalize it from a simple circuit board to a general causal model. Okay? So what do we have so far? We have a bunch of variables that we call endogenous, lots of variables that we would like to explain what determines their values. There's some variables that we consider to be background variables, U. Okay? Those that we give up, we arbitrarily make a choice that we wish not to explain them. Okay? And then we have a set of functions. What are the gates? Okay? Every function has input and output. The output is VI, variable number I. Okay? And the input comes from two sources. A set of variables which are endogenous, we call them parents for very good reason, and some component or some variables from the background variables, UI. And the collection of such functions, okay, it constitutes a causal model. Plus, we have to have an operator, which I call mutilation operator, which interprets what we mean by intervention. So that will go the next. Well, that only shows you what parents are. For every causal model, you'll have a diagram that represents some aspect of it. Who connects to whom? And who is input and who is output? Okay? Here's an example of two equations, okay? Two of those functions. And you see that the parents of Q is P and I. P and I are the parents of Q. Right? The parents of P are Q and W, so on. So that only explains to you what the parents are, and you see why they are called parents, because in the diagram they emanate arrows toward the child, and we're going to use child-parent relationship, family relationship, when we talk about diagrams. And now comes the mutilation operator, and it's described like that. From when you perform an action, it corresponds to changing something in the model. Then you form another model, which we may regard as a mutilation of the original one. When you talk about an action described by a proposition like do X, or raise taxes, make him laugh, an action which is specified by the immediate result of that action, then we are talking about a special kind of atomic intervention, special kind of mutilation. It involves taking the set of functions that were there before and deleting the functions that correspond to the mechanism that previously determined the variables which you are about to manipulate. So did you delete from the set of functions that which previously determined the value of the variables, and now you replace it by constant. Let me give you an example. Same economical model, price and quantities. Okay? For instance, when you are dealing with fixing the price fixing, okay, this is how life behaves under normal conditions. If government decides to fix the price, namely, that means that wages and quantities no longer determine price, but who determines price? The government. Okay? So you perturb, you decapacitate the previous influences on P, and you subject P to a new force, to a new mechanism, namely the government, or whatever determines the price. If the price is P0, from now on it's going to be a constant P0. Okay? So you have a new model, M sub X, which is the result of performing any manipulation on the original model M. And now you have a new set of functions, a new models, new computer to answer questions about the new life which is created, or the new world which is created after manipulation. That's the entire story about manipulation. And if you really want to be sophisticated, you can decorate them with probabilities. So if you do not know, if you do not know the values of the background variables, you express your uncertainty using a probability function of those variables, and then you have a probabilistic causal model. Once you have a probability assigned to the background variables, it induces a probability on every endogenous variable, and then you can compute the probabilities for every combinations or any Boolean functions defined on the endogenous variables. I finished with the formal part. Now we are going to start enjoying the power of these simple mathematical entities. I'm sorry for boring you for the past two, but I had to do it so that things would be clear. So what is a causal model? A bunch of functions. Each one corresponds to a mechanism. That mechanism is invariant. If you manipulate one mechanism, the others do not change, and that's the whole story. Counterfactual. Once you have a causal model of that nature, it allows you to answer queries about counterfactual. For example, y would be small y had x been x. We denote it by y sub x. And that sentence translates into y sub x in context u is equal to small y. What does it mean? We have a causal model. It means we look at the solution of y in the mutilated model, m sub x, with the equation for x replaced by a constant. Once we have a mutilated model, we can still compute solve for y. The solution thus obtained is the answer to the counterfactual query, what would be the value of y had x been small x. So now the counterfactuals are well defined, they have a nice semantics, and we can continue the game. What about, for instance, a joint probability of counterfactuals? What's the probability that y would be small y had x been x, and z would be small z had w been small w? Sounds complex, right? But it isn't complex. All it is the sum over all the probabilities on all the exogenous variables such that they make this sentence true. Y sub x equal to small y, and z sub w equal to z. In particular, we have certain counterfactual queries which are commonly used. What would be the probability of y if we do x? Translate into counterfactual sentence the probability that y would obtain the value small y had x been x. Compute it in the same way. Here is a more complex one. What's the probability that y would be, that given that currently x is equal to small x and y is equal to small y, that y would not be equal to y, but will be different. It will be y prime had x been x prime. It sounds like complex queries, but actually it's well defined and easily computed by the definition. I'll show you how easily it is computed using this example. Assuming that you have a firing squad, and here is a prisoner that can be either dead or alive, and here we have two riflemen, A and B, waiting for a signal from a captain, and the captain is waiting for order from the court. Okay? We have a nice causal chain, court given order, captain raises the flag, A and B shoot, prisoner is dead. Okay? Now, I want to ask a question. If the prisoner is dead, he would still be dead if A were not to have shot. Okay. Want to know whether it's true or false? The way to do that, according to our semantics, is very simple. You know that the prisoner is currently dead, okay? So D is true. It allows you to infer something about the court order. because you have all the functions here, all, right? So you infer that this is true, that the court has given an order, otherwise the prisoner would not be dead. Once you know that the court has given an order, you perform the counterfactual mutilation. It says, if, you'll go to antecedent, if A were not to have shot. So you reverse the truth value of A from true to false. And now you have a new model, and in the new model you answer the query. Would the prisoner still be dead? Let's see. It's just a collection of functions, right? If this is true, it allows me to compute the value of D. I compute it, zoop, and what do I find? It's true. So I assign a truth value to the counterfactual sentence. Very easy. Now, if you want to be very sophisticated, you ask a probabilistic question. Okay, what's the probability? Suppose I don't know whether the court has given an order. So I have a probability on the verdict being innocent or guilty. But I see that the prisoner is dead. What does it mean? It means that I instantiate the value of D to true. That allows me to update the probability of court giving a guilty verdict from P of U into P of U given D. Can I compute it? Surely I can, because I have all the functions there. So I can just update and compute the probability of U given D. Keeping the same probability of U given D, I now go to the model and I mutilate it in order to implement the antecedent if A were not to have shot. So I implement that in the new model, keeping the same probability here, and I have a new model now with new probability assigned to U, mutilated arc here, which I can solve for the probability of D. And I find the answer to the query here. How likely is it that he would have been dead, he would be dead if A were not to have shot? Sounds complicated sentence, right? But computationally, it's very simple. Okay? I still have some time. I'm always scared of the clock. Now, what happened in the past 15 years, as far as I'm concerned, is that causal inference became mathematized due to three advances. One is inference with non-parametric structural equations was made possible through graphical analysis. We obtained a mathematical underpinning of counterfactual in terms of those non-parametric structural equations, and we understand the symbiosis between graphical and counterfactual analysis. I'll demonstrate it as I go through. A concept I'm going to talk about is identifiability. It's very important because it tells you how sensitive things, the answers are to the details of the model. Remember, we started by hypothesizing that we have a model with all the functions, with all the values of the endogenous variables. That's an idealization. In practice, we do not have. What we do have is, say, just the graph. So we have a collection of assumptions about the model. And the question is, how sensitive would the answer to the query be if to the details of the model that are missing? If the details do not matter, then we say that the answer to the query is identified, or the query is identified. So here's the definition. A quantity that is computable from the model is identified relative to the set of assumptions if whenever two models give you the same probability, they also give you the same answer to your query. Namely, all that matters is the probability that you observe and not the details of the model. In other words, Q can be determined uniquely from the probability distribution, which is estimatable, on the endogenous variables and the assumptions that are embedded in the model. I'll demonstrate the question of identifiability in three types of queries. Finding the causal effects, or the effect of intervention. Find the probability of Y given that you do X. This is what I call a probability of necessity, or probability of causation. Find the probability that Y would not be equal to small y, but to some other value, had X been different than what it is now, given that X is X and Y is small y. Right? And here is the direct effect. I'll explain it more carefully later on. This fundamental theorem in causal inference that allows you to compute all these crazy queries is the following. I call it the causal Markov theorem. It said that any distribution generated by Markovian structural model, here's the definition of Markovian structural model. It's recursive, maybe you don't have feedback, and independent disturbances. So the U variables are independently distributed. That's the definition of Markovian model. If you have such a model, then regardless of the details of the model, regardless of the functional form of the Fi functions, regardless of distributions of the disturbances, the resulting distribution is going to be decomposed by this product. It's very well known. Product of the of conditional probability of each variable given its parent in the diagram. So all you need to know is the diagram, and you can decompose the distribution into such a form. The corollary is that we can compute from a Markovian model the probability under manipulations, because under manipulation doesn't change the Markovian property of the model. Whatever was Markovian remains Markovian. Therefore, the mutilated model remains Markovian, and you can apply the theorem to the mutilated model. And what does it mean? The distributions of the mutilated the distribution resulting from the manipulation is also decomposed into a product form, but now the product runs only on those variables which are not manipulated. Okay? So it's truncated product decomposition. With this theorem and its corollary, you can algebraically derive essentially everything that you can find in my book. My book only provides you with shortcuts, but the essence is right there. Here's an example. Suppose this is how you perceive of the relationship between smoking and cancer. Okay? We have some unobserved genotype, which may puts a person into a cancer risk, and also makes a person crave for nicotine. And here's the tar deposits in the lungs, which probably comes about from smoking, and probably puts a person in cancer risk. So this is a specific, you may argue with that, but it's a common perception of the relationship between smoking and cancer. And the question is, given observations only on smoking, tar deposit, and cancer, can you infer now what would be, can you answer the question, should we ban smoking? I mean, what will be the rate in cancer cases in the population if we ban smoking? Now, banning smoking means that you take this model and you transform it, you mutilate it, and you turn it into that kind of model, where you sever the links between the genotype and smoking, and you make X, that is smoking, be no, zero, a constant. That's a mutilated version of the original model. And the question is, can we figure that out? what would be the effect? That corresponds to answering a causal query. Find the probability, given that you do X, that you make sure that smoking is zero. It cannot be answered here from the joint probability, but it can be answered using the decomposition. Assuming that you know U, you can write down the probability of the intervention, the probability of Y and Z under intervention using our corollary. It's still not answerable because now we have a U which is unobserved, the genotype. And the question of identifiability boils down to, can you eliminate U from that expression? If you're successful, then you can express that query or the answer to that query in terms of observed quantities. So this is the essence of identifiability. You can try and manipulate that expression, try to eliminate U if you are good algebraist. Okay. I'm a lazy person, and I prefer to work with graphs rather than manipulating algebraic expression. So there are tricks, graphical tricks, that permit you to answer these queries by purely graphical methods. One looks at the diagram, and one determines whether that complex quantity is identifiable. Here's one trick. It's a graphical test for identifiability called backdoor criterion. You take your graph, you want to find if the effect of X and Y is identifiable. You eliminate the errors emanating from X, and you look at the remaining graph. If you find a set Z such that once you condition on Z, X and Y becomes independent, and we have a graphical test for independence called deseparation, okay, then you know that the effect of X and Y is identifiable. That's only one trick. There are many other tricks. I just want to give you the flavor. Okay. Here's the whole calculus that allows you to figure out, manipulate expression of that sort to obtain other expression with that sort. This expression which involves a do operator together with straight conditioning. This is the passive observation, and this is fixing. Make sure that X is equal to X. And here are rules that allow you to manipulate such expression, with the help of which you might be lucky and eliminate the red do X symbol. And if you are lucky, then you end up with identifiable quantity. Here's an example. If we do that to the smoking cancer case, we want to answer this query. Find the probability of C given do S. Find whether this is identifiable from observations alone. And the trick is to eliminate the red symbols from the expression by applying those three rules repeatedly, like you do, like you solve algebraic equation in high school. If you are successful, and here we are successful, then you rejoice. Why you rejoice? Because you are successful in eliminating a causal quantity and end up with observable or estimatable quantities. Purely white properties are things you can estimate from passive observation. Just to give you a flavor, I'm not going to go through them at this time that I am allowed, but to give you a flavor of what one can do with the calculus of causal relationships. We talked about the effect of potential intervention. Now let's talk about the claims about attribution. It's a different character altogether. Here is the context. Your Honor, my client, Mr. A, died because he used that drug. Therefore, he would like to get compensation, or his family would like to get compensation of $1.5 million. Okay. Now, what does it mean? What does it mean here, because? Lawyers have been very smart, very careful in defining liability. And they use, in definition, they use two counterfactual equations. Oh, they use two phrases which are interesting. One of them is probabilistic. court to decide if it is more probable than not that A would be alive but for the drug. So the legal definition invokes counterfactual term, but for, and also probabilistic term. It ought to be more probable than not that A, Mr. A, yeah, would be alive but for the drug. When you see probability, you right away we write P, you open parentheses, and we write greater than 50%, because more probable than not, right? But what expression here, probability of what, should be greater than 50%? Well, what do we know about the fellow? A is dead, and he took his drug. Okay. What do we put here? We want to put that he would be alive. But if we put here alive, we get a contradiction, because A is dead. If we put the probability that he is alive, we get zero. So obviously, we have to put something else there. Okay? What is that that we put there in order to satisfy the lawyers? So the question is, what do we mean by the probability of necessity? The probability that event Y would not have occurred if it were not for event X, given that X and Y did in fact occur. Okay. That's our case. And the answer is, since we have a model for counterfactual, we don't hesitate. We can write the answer immediately. Okay. We just write down in our notation, right, given that X and Y did in fact occur, we put it after the conditioning bar, and here we put the argument of the probability that Y would not occur, namely would be Y prime, had X occur, had X been, what is it? If it were not for event X, so X is actually X prime. So Y would attain the value of Y prime had X been X prime, where in fact X now attains the value X and Y attains the value Y. Is this quantity well defined? Yes, it is. Because all counterfactuals are well defined in our model. So the only problem is to compute it. But that's a secondary thing. To compute, we also notice it's very easy with our propagation of up and down. So we simply are, we're not intimidated, okay, by the complexity of what appears to be a complex query. We simply write mathematically what it means, and we compute it. The question is, under what condition can this quantity be learned from statistical data or estimated from statistical data, both observational and experimental or combined? I'll skip that. So assuming that the plaintiff brings two bunch of data here experimental, namely under controlled randomized experiment, and here are non-experimental. Well, we all know that non-experimental data is suspect because it's confounded. If you look at the data, you see that from experimental data we find a drug has negligible effect on survival. Okay? But the plaintiff claim that, so definitely it doesn't seem like it's going to exceed the 50% rule. However, the plaintiff claims that Mr. A is special. It's not part of the overall, not represented by the population. What's special about Mr. A, the client? But two things are there special about him. He actually died. And that's not represented in the non-experimental data, right? It's a class of people that actually died. Second, he used the drug by choice, so it doesn't correspond to the experiment here. None of these fellows used the drugs by choice. They were forced to use the drugs by the experimental protocol. They were randomized and chosen for the treatment group. Okay? So the court must decide on basis of this data now whether this quantity exceeds 50%. It turns out one can analyze it and provide bound. Okay? I'm just giving you a flavor of the bounds that one can get. If you don't know anything, you get this bound. If you know something about the nature of the functions, monotonicity, for instance, you can get identifiability. and so on. But what's special about the two tables that I crafted is that the lower bound here is happened to be one. Okay? In which case, the answer is clear here. Guilty. Okay? Not only guilty, but not only exceeding 50%, but with probability one, you can say that Mr. A would be alive had they not taken the drug. First, it boggles the mind. How can you get probability one if you have small sample, okay? What does it mean to have from population data to individual case? Well, we're not doing individual case. Mr. A could be really very queer kind of client, okay? But we are instructed by code to take into account the characteristic of Mr. A. And we took two characteristics into account. He took the drug by choice, and he is dead. If he also knew that he's redhead, red-haired, or that he is left-handed, okay, we could, if we had the data, to incorporate those pieces of information. But we didn't. We took into account the characteristics which are available about Mr. A. And the nice thing about this exercise is to show that sometimes when you combine data, you combine experimental data with non-experimental data, you get more information than from either component alone. Okay. For me, it was the first time I saw it. Because normally, you throw out the non-experimental data because it's confounded and so on, and experimental is neat and randomized and controlled. Okay. Here's a case where it ain't true. Both reveal information. Now let's go to the last one. It's claims about direct and indirect effect. These are very common in language. And then you wrote about the birth control pill, remember, and the thrombosis. That's an exercise with the semantics of direct and indirect effect. So the first question is, what is the semantics of direct and indirect effect?
Jordan, are you watching the time?
I watch the time. Yes. I'm going to take some minutes from your questions. Okay? It's very interesting. Can we estimate those from that? You see, in linear analysis, there's no question about the semantics of direct indirect effect. If you have two linear structural equations, the semantic of a total effect is you wiggle x, you see what happened to y. Okay? So you're trying to figure out the expected value of y. If you do x, take partial derivative with respect to x, it gives you a plus bc. No problem. Wiggle x, see what happens to y. Direct effect is keep everything constant. Everything. Okay? In this case, just z. And then wiggle x and see what happens to y. In our case, we get only a. Beautiful. What about the indirect effect? Well, in linear analysis, they just take the difference. Ask why, and there's no good reason. But in nonlinear analysis, things are getting a little touchy, a little hairy here. First, if you want to apply the same semantics and say the effect of x, direct effect of x on y means the effect of x on y when you keep everything else constant, constant I mean by hand, you hold it, not condition on it. Okay? You force it to be constant. And the question is at what value you keep c? Because you get different value if you keep z a different value. And then the indirect effect is void of any semantics. There is no result of experiments. There's no experiment, the result of which would correspond to indirect effect. Because you cannot incapacitate the direct effect. So how can you energize only the indirect links here and decapacitate directly? There's nothing you can hold constant in order to neutralize that connection. But it turns out there's a way out of it. You can define what I call natural direct effect, and Robbins and Greenland called it pu. It goes like that. Here is a nice definition. The direct effect of x and y is the expected change in y per unit change of x. That's all nice and clear. When we keep z constant at whatever value it attains before the change. Okay? Now, how do we express whatever value it attained before the change? It's counterfactual. It's nested counterfactual. Z is kept at some value, but what value? Whatever Z would obtain if I were to keep X at X0. Okay? So it's nested counterfactual here. It has policy implication. For instance, if you want to talk about I'll give you. Yeah, okay, here it is. I know it has social implication here. Suppose you want to find the effect of gender on hiring if sex discrimination is eliminated. If eliminating sex discrimination means that this link no longer exists. And then if you want to find what the effect of gender on hiring, then you end up only with the indirect effect. Okay? And naturally, we do the same to indirect effect. Expected change of Y when you keep it. When we let Z change to whatever value it would have under a unit change of X. Again, nested counterfactual. Here is how lawmakers define discrimination in hiring. And notice that they go after the natural conception. Oh, I'm sorry. I went too fast. Previous one. Let me read it to you so you can see the nested counterfactuals in the law books. Yeah. The central question in any employment discrimination case is whether the employer would have taken the same action had the employee been of different race or age and so on, and everything else had been the same. The same as what? The same as it is under the opposite sex. How do we write that definition? So here's the formalization of no discrimination. Okay? A nested counterfactual here equal to the hiring under male, let's say. Okay. Now, is that the quantity defined, the nested counterfactual? Well, sure it is. Because if counterfactual is defined, then nested counterfactual is also defined. Here, look at that. Let's look at this term. What does it mean? It means find first the solution for Z in a set of equations that would obtain if we were to mutilate things into X star. It has some value under you, right? Keep that value constant, and then find the solution for Y when you keep X constant at X and Z at whatever solution you obtained before. So it's well defined. And the nice thing is that we can now answer the question, can it be estimated? From both experimental and non-experimental data. Here is an example of the answers. We have a map of the kind of graphs that lends to identification of such nested counterfactual. We know that it is always identifiable if you have Markovian models, which is something people didn't realize. And also, one can give policy interpretation to such questions about direct and indirect effect. I'm coming now to the last. Okay. I must take 5 more minutes and talk about the connection now to certain questions in the logic of science that have been asked by philosophers. Let's talk about falsifiability and corroboration and see how they are reflected in the microcosm of causal models. Okay? Now, assuming that you have a model M, that model defines the probability distribution, P. And if the model doesn't have all the parameters specified, then you have a set of probabilities distribution that could be generated by the model. Now, here's a set of all possible probability distributions in the world. If the set permissible by the model is a subset of P star, then we have falsifiability, namely, there are statistical implications. The model introduces a certain restrictions on possible observations. So if the model introduces the constraints, it is falsifiable. There is a probability distribution lying here is that if I were to observe it, I would say the model is wrong. There are excluded probability. So this is very, very well defined. Okay? It's nothing, very easy to not only to define, but also to compute. Here are the type of constraints that one finds in causal modeling. The most typical one are conditional independency constraints. If you have a graph, you know that if you condition on the parents, then the variables, the sum, is independent on all the rest. So these are the type of conditional independencies. But there are other constraints that the model induces. For instance, inequality constraints. If you have a restricted domain, for instance, binary, if all variables are binaries, then in certain cases, even if you don't have conditional independencies, the model itself, the structure of the model, induces inequalities on the observed distributions. And here are functional constraints. It's hard to see here and hard to derive, but one can show that in this model, okay, that quantity is independent on W. It's just a function of Y and Z. Okay? And recently we have a paper showing systematically extracting those kind of constraints. So there are algebraic constraints that one can, which are detectable, that are implied by the model. And here are more testable claims. This is the kind of Bell inequality, and depends what you know ahead of time, but I'm not going to concentrate on that. I would like to go to corroboration, and that's my last topic here. So how do we define corroboration? A data said to corroborate a model, if M is falsifiable, and the data is compatible with, or the model is compatible with D. Namely, if you have a data that falls in this area, you say it corroborates the model. Because the model could have been falsified, and it wasn't. Wow, it's a miracle. Corroborates. We know in philosophy of science how it gave rise to the Raven effect and the Gru and Schmoo effect. But let's look at how it appears in the microcosm of microcosms of the causal models. Again, what is a model? A model is a desk calculator that gives you answers to queries. The answers to queries are claimed about the world. Okay? So instead of talking about a model being corroborated by data, we should really talk about whether a claim is corroborated by data, because that is a function of the model. And indeed, you can see that certain claims can be corroborated while others are not. Take, for instance, that model, okay? That, does it make a claim about the world? Yes, it says that Z is independent of X and Y. So it has testable implications. However, since Z is totally irrelevant, the model is, suppose I'm interested in the parameter A. Introducing this Z into the model doesn't make A more corroborated than it was before. So certain properties of the models are corroborated, and certain ones are totally irrelevant. Take B, for instance. That's different, because B, let me now give you a definition. Then you can see that B is corroborated by data, and A is not. You want to make sure that the reasons, that the constraints of the model that were satisfied by the data are induced by the assumptions in the model that are relevant for the identification of the properties you are after. In this case, for instance, that is why we have a definition. A claim is corroborated by data if some minimal set of assumptions in M sufficient for identifying the claim is corroborated by the data. In this way, we eliminate the problem of irrelevant variables and irrelevant claims. The nice thing is that this definition, which looks like a minimal set of assumptions, has a nice graphical interpretation. A minimal set of assumptions correspond to a maximal supergraph. Here's an example. What is an assumption in the model? Assumption is lack of link. That introduces a certain constraint, right? If I eliminate these assumptions, I have a supergraph, a graph with more links than the original ones. Okay? I can now ask whether in this supermodel I can identify B or identify A. Here's another example of a supergraph. Okay? In this supergraph, I know I can identify B and I cannot identify A. So by looking at supergraphs, maximal supergraph that makes a certain parameters identifiable, one can list the set of minimal submodels, and one can then define the degree of corroboration. Some claims will be more corroborated than others, and some even though the modeling itself appears to be corroborated by your data. And that brings me to the final one. Now the overview makes sense, I hope. So thank you for being so attentive. And I'm glad we still have 17 minutes for questions.
Okay. Questions, remarks? Sorry you came in after we started. Anybody wants to ask a question, I'm afraid has got to come downstairs. Somebody downstairs already? Yes, please.
Hi.
Wait a sec. Now you're going to get a mic. That's why one has to be downstairs.
I'd like to ask how important you consider causality versus probabilistic dependency in these models. So if, say, I have some model where I have some links, but not enough prior knowledge to determine the cause-to-effect direction, can I still use these models in this useful way to apply inference?
You're referring to the task of inferring causal relationship from a physical relationship, such as dependencies, right? No, you can't, unless you make some assumptions. But the nice thing is we know what assumptions one needs to make today in order to answer your questions. If you make if you restrict yourself to a certain class of models, say, for instance, Markovian, okay, then the answer is yes. Under certain conditions, certain pattern of dependency give rise to a small set of possible models, and a certain causal relationship may exist in all of those patterns, in all of those models in the class that remains. And in which case, the answer is yes, we can induce causal relationship from conditional dependencies. But if you don't make the assumptions, then you are unable to restrict the class of model, and then the answer is no. What I can say is now we know what assumptions one needs to make in order to answer your questions.
Yes. And then Elliot.
Well, one thing I get very clearly from your talk is why perhaps courts of law should not base their judgments on consequences of counterfactual, but they should base their judgments on looking at decisions.
I didn't get the first sentence.
Courts of law should not base their...
A court of law. But they do.
Right, but what compared to what you said is that perhaps they shouldn't, and they should base it instead on decisions. To take your definition of causation as a necessary condition, if you consider first this case, if it's a classic case which I'll tell the simple form, two people similar. simultaneously decide to shoot someone in the head independently, then by your definition of causation, neither of them is guilty of killing this person. This person would have died anyway. That's fortunate that they could be convicted of attempted murder. That's because we have a law that acts on intent, not on action. So that would be one case where the law seems to be wrong thing. An opposite case would be, to take your form people as an example, suppose you have someone has a condition and there's some sort of drug that if they take it, a large number of people will be saved, but a small number of people who would have been okay will actually die, and those two categories are mutually exclusive. Then by your definition, of course, of counterfactual, you'd say in all those cases where the people die, they would have been killed by the drug. Nevertheless, the decision to give them the drug on the information that was available at the time made this correct decision. So using counterfactual seems to lead to wrong decisions.
No, it's not the wrong decisions according to the definition of liability. It may be the wrong decisions if you are a policymaker and your job is to improve public health. But in terms of liability...
So the question, should we define liability in a different way given that these cases exist?
This is a question to lawmakers. From what I know about the lawmaker concentrate on the plaintiff. And the query that needs to be answered is whether the plaintiff, as an individual, would have died had they not taken the drug. Not about the population.
Elliot, here in the front row, please.
I was puzzled by the way you were characterizing corroboration. Maybe I misunderstood it, but it looked like a set of data could corroborate a model even when the data set is entirely irrelevant, because first the model is falsifiable and the data set is logically compatible with the model. Am I misunderstanding what your proposal is?
Yes. No. That's exactly the question I try to answer.
But do you see the puzzlement? Because it seems that gathering data that couldn't possibly falsify a model, I mean, if you're thinking of this in a kind of Popperian way, that couldn't corroborate it either. But according to your definition, I think it could, because the model is falsifiable by some data or other.
That's right.
And you have some irrelevant data which is logically compatible with the model, satisfying your definition
of
corroboration.
And that is why I'm going from corroboration of a model to corroboration of the claims made by the model. And when you talk about individual claims, I could then eliminate this puzzle of irrelevant variables, okay, and focus on the assumptions in the model that are necessary to make the claim identifiable. So that is a cure that I am proposing, to focus on the claims made on the model and not on the model.
What's the difference between the model and the claims that one is making about the model? I mean, isn't the latter just a subset of the former? I mean,
no.
Isn't the model just a set of claims?
Model has a set of claims, but many, many claims, right? Many of which are derivable from a small basis claims, those which are represented by the missing link in the model. Okay, the model is a set of claims that define the structure of the model, from which you can derive other claims. Okay? Now, when you talk about corroborations, one is normally interested in a specific set of claims, not in its totality. Okay? And this confusion between the totality of claims implied by the model and specific claims gives rise to the irrelevant paradox there. So if you focus on a specific claim and say, is that one corroborated by the data, then you eliminate many of those paradoxes.
Would the same definition of corroboration be used, that a specific claim made by a model is corroborated by data if that claim is falsifiable and, secondly, that the data are compatible with that claim about the model?
No.
That's not the idea.
Not the definition. You need to have a twist there. That the minimal set of assumptions necessary for making the claim identifiable is corroborated.
all the way in the back row.
It looked to me a little bit like you were committed to the view that the cause raises the probability of the effect.
I'm not.
Oh, okay, good.
No. I haven't defined that in such a manner. Okay? It might be a byproduct, a surface effect of many of the examples I've shown here, but I do not consider that to be an essential part of definition of a cause.
Other questions, remarks?
Actually, I haven't given you a definition of a cause.
No.
Okay, so far. Because I don't think it's necessary. I've given you a definition of queries about causation, a specific relationship, specific claims that invoke causal relationship. Right? For instance, I can ask the query, would the probability of Y increase if I were to do X? Okay, a specific claim or specific query. If the answer is yes, I can define X to be a cause of Y in that sense, but I have other senses. Am I clear? So answering a specific question, a specific claim about the world, what will happen if we do, or what will happen if we observe, or what will happen if we do once we observe, and so on. All counterfactual, okay? Each query defines a certain claim, and you can attribute causal relationship to those claims. But to talk about cause in generality, it makes no sense. Because you may confuse direct cause with total cause, indirect cause, and so on. These are specific definitions, they make a specific claim about the world, and they can be used to define the word cause. But I don't think it's necessary or it makes sense to define a cause in general.
But Judea, maybe I can never remember which language you use and which language Clark, Gleemore, et cetera, use. But what about this assumption? What role does this assumption called faithfulness play? Whenever you draw an arrow in the graph, then there's going to be a probabilistic dependence between the two factors.
It plays no role
in whatever you said today, right?
No. Because I haven't dealt with the question raised here of how to infer causal relationship from passive observations. I haven't dealt with it.
I just thought that might have been it might have been that it sometimes one does use, you do use that assumption is what prompted his question is what I was thinking. Uh-huh. So you do use it at some points for other purposes.
This assumption is used sometimes, me too in chapter 2, right? When we are involved in the exercise of inferring causal relationship from conditional independences, we use that assumption in order to limit the space of possible causal models.
Richard? It's coming, Richard.
In the nice simple case where you've got the true causal model for you, then you can ask counterfactual questions and you'll get nice clean answers. But in sort of general situation, the plenty of situations you don't know that perhaps you have two models in front of you. Now you want to know what would happen if I were to do such and such.
If you were?
If I were to,
yes.
Or something were to happen, and the two models give me different answers. I'm just wondering whether there's anything that you can tell us than that just the two models will give different answers to the counterfactual question. And in particular, whether you countenance cases where your favouring of one model or the other might somewhat depend on whether you thought that the counterfactual hypothesis itself had any plausibility or not. That is, that where you thought whether A or B was the right model somewhat depended on whether you thought it was plausible that
such and such were to happen.
I see that you have a Bayesian upbringing.
Yes.
If you are Bayesian, you can decorate all that with subjective probability and say we have a prior preference on models, okay, based on elegance, simplicity, whatever other reasons, or just gut feel. Fine. That's perfectly incorporated in that game. But I haven't talked about that. The concept of identifiability is orthogonal to what you're saying. If I have no preference among models, I still would like to know under what condition all possible models subject to my assumptions give rise to the same answer. So that is the idea of identifiability, insensitivity to the details of the model.
Did you want to follow that up, Richard? Okay. One last question, and then...
A question just for clarification. Would it be correct to say that you are implicitly imposing constraints on the space of allowable queries? For example, an allowable query should not itself use the concept of causality. That's in the model, but never in the query. Do you have constraints of that kind? Are there limits on what kinds of query are allowed?
I can say yes and no. Let me start with a no. I don't put any constraints, but I'll give you an answer. I can look at your queries and tell you right away that with that kind of model, you cannot answer it. For instance, if you have only a statistical model and you ask me what will happen if I do X, I can tell you without even looking at the model, you cannot answer it. Similarly, if you ask a counterfactual question, okay, and I look at your model and I see it has no deterministic functions there, then I can tell you right away you cannot answer it. In other questions, in other more intricate case, not as simple as that, right, I have to look at the model, look at the structure, grind through the machinery, and derive the answer. Yes, I can answer your question. No, I cannot answer it.
Okay. We have a reception to attend to celebrate Judea's presence and his wonderful book. So we'll close the formal session right now and thank Judea again for a marvelous work.
Thank you all for your receptiveness and attention.